This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now today, the United States will leave Afghanistan. The last troops will depart, and what has been tragic situation that we've witnessed in terrible graphic detail around Kabul airport will be gone. That image will stay in people's minds, I imagine, for a very, very long time. And of course, the death of 70 Afghans, including women and children, and 13 US troops last Friday will also linger long in people's memory. The scenes around the airport in Kabul, named after an Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, ironically, will be with us for a very long time, rather like the scenes of Americans clambering aboard a helicopter taking off from the roof of the American embassy in Saigon all those years ago, left an image of the West in retreat, of failed policy and of human tragedy, and of human tragedy in Afghanistan, the despair and the anguish of those people. We'll hear a lot more, I'm sure. This is another really bad day for the West, and to discuss Afghanistan, the surrender to the Taliban and matters related, it's a pleasure to welcome to The Stand Professor Diarmaid Farrington, Professor of Modern Irish History at UCD, and Chris Johns. Chris is a former chief economist at the Bank of Ireland, now a successful commentator with his own podcast, indeed, with Jim Power, which is called On the Other Hand, or rather The Other Hand, to discuss what we have witnessed in recent times. Diarmaid, you wrote a very good piece in the Irish Times last week, a superb piece about this tragedy and its unfolding. And whilst Joe Biden is the person in the White House at the moment, and Biden has always been against foreign incursions by American troops, this is likely to define his presidency in not a very good way. It also, does it not, signals the extent to which Americans now are heading into isolationism?
I think one of the reasons why Joe Biden was so keen to get out of Afghanistan was because he does want a concentration on domestic issues, what you might call isolationism. I don't know if we can say it's going to define his presidency. It's too early to say that. But certainly you can see over the last couple of weeks a president who's flailing and struggling to control, obviously, the narrative, to communicate to a domestic audience that this is in the best interests of America. You know, if things calm down, as they might, albeit temporarily, it may well be that the domestic agenda will once again come to the fore and he can get back on more comfortable ground. But as a historian, of course, I'm well aware of how tragically messy these withdrawals can be. And you'll be aware, of course, that Biden has referred to hunting down the perpetrators of the kind of massacres that you're talking about. Now, what does that mean long term? Does it mean still a bit in, not completely out? What does it mean in relation to America's leadership role and all that? Because that's the other big question, of course, it raises. You know, what is America's role now in relation to foreign policy? What's a Biden foreign policy going to involve, particularly in that part of the world? And that raises, of course, a much broader context about the extent to which America is in any sense now in control, either in the Middle East or in Central Asia. And of course, they're not just questions that belong to the Biden era and the Biden presidency, which is still in its infancy. There's much, much bigger, wider questions there that go way back. And, you know, even talking to students about Afghanistan and the reason why it's of such strategic interest, we were talking about the Anglo-Afghan wars of the 19th century, you know, that you have to go back that far to begin to look at the roots of Western involvement in Afghanistan and all of the regional disputes that go on, but also the extent to which we constantly hear the assertion of a new world order. Like, what's the new world order now in the context of what's going on in Afghanistan? And what does that mean for America? And what does it mean for the West?
Yes, indeed. And I think that's really the question that is bigger and deeper than Afghanistan. Chris, can I put it to you, you know, the two great, this is an Anglo-American effort in Afghanistan, which started 20 years ago with George W. Bush and Tony Blair, vowing that first of all, they would get Osama bin Laden, and that secondly, when they were done, the mission was complete, there would be no more terrorist haven in Afghanistan, and Al-Qaeda, who were the terrorists at the time they were out to get, did disappear, but it's clear that terrorism still exists in Afghanistan. The point Dermot raised there at the end, what does it mean for us in the West? And is it this? The Brexit saw a division and a bitter division between Europe and the United Kingdom. The Trump presidency saw bitter divisions between Europe and the United States, between the United States and NATO, the United States and the EU, the United States and the UN, questioning, in Trump's case, what use were these multilateral organizations? Where are we now with all these divisions in the West? And could we and can we summon up a response to the tyrants in the world that the West will continue to have to face?
Those are lots of questions, and it presupposes that something does exist called the West. And Dermot's probably far better qualified than me to answer that question, and knows better than me that the West is essentially a post-World War II construct that used to be all about the Cold War between Russia and the United States. And that took many different dimensions, involved some proxy wars, as we know all too well. If you wanted to ask the question, what is the West now? I think all that would do would be to raise further questions that needed to be placed in a historical context. If it exists in some meaningful way, the next question that needs to be asked is, what does it stand for? And I think that that was a good question before these events, and it's an even more pertinent one now, but even more difficult to answer. Because if you asked, well, what are the values of the West that it seeks to defend? Is it prepared to defend them? An equally important question is, what strategic interests does the West have? Is there a coherent list of these things that we could identify as in the way that we can probably do much easier with China? China defines its strategic interests very clearly and clearly has an executable plan. Particularly the Belt and Road Initiative that it is developing around the world. It's very hard. It's very easy to ask all of those questions, but very hard to answer them. You raise the issue of Brexit as being one aspect of that, and that's one example, if you like, of the fracturing of the West. The EU exists very much as part of the West. Again, the historian would know that Europe used to be called Christendom, and it has taken many forms since it used to be called that. And now the EU stands for what? A big part of the West, those big strategic questions I asked about what the West is, what its interests are, what its strategic objectives are, what its values are. We could ask the same questions about the subdivides within the West. What does the EU stand for? Brexit has helped that process, actually. It's helped the EU define certainly what it's not, and it's not what Britain stands for. So that speaks to a new divide. Other questions that arise from this will be asked by America's allies. Not just in the West can we rely on the United States to both define and protect our interests, but non-Western countries, I'm thinking here particularly of places like Taiwan and South Korea, will no doubt be asking themselves today, can we rely on the United States to protect our interests, particularly Taiwan, I suspect, going forward? They may well conclude that America will be far more interested in defending Taiwan from the almost, as they're regularly reported, daily threats from China wanting Taiwan back, and the United States promised to defend Taiwan, for example, should it ever come to that. And I think these are legitimate questions to which we don't have many answers, but all we have are those divides that you speak of.
Yeah, Dermot, isn't Afghanistan and the failure there a cautionary tale from an American perspective?
Well, there's no doubt. Yeah,
that you get no pleasure and you get no profit. You spend a lot of treasure and blood, they call it, and America has spent a lot of treasure and blood, not just there, but in Iraq and in other places. I have an image in my mind, Dermot, of John F. Kennedy standing in Berlin saying, "Ein Berliner." I too am a Berliner. This was when the wall was being built, and this is when the Russians were threatening Berlin, all of it. This was an American president leading the world and signaling his country's commitment to something bigger than itself. The same could be argued of Roosevelt. Roosevelt entering the war and that being very meaningful. Could we say that if circumstances arose, and Chris referred there to Taiwan, and he very rightly, because Taiwan is very vulnerable and China feels very strongly about Taiwan, can we say in an age when less than a year ago the Chinese tore up the agreement they made with Margaret Thatcher and have imposed authoritarianism in Hong Kong, that the West is A, coherent, but B, has the political will, and I'm thinking of America in particular, and indeed the UK, the political will to lead?
I think the fracturing is very evident, and Chris referred to it there, and it's very relevant to your question about leadership. I mean, you're talking there about a defining moment or a defining rhetorical gesture, really, on the part of JFK, and the idea that the Western way would triumph. And of course, that narrative was sustained right up through subsequent decades. I mean, I started in UCD in the autumn of 1989 as a history student, and I vividly remember the images of the fall of the Berlin Wall. And of course, this seems to be the vindication of what JFK had been saying in the 1960s. And there was much talk then about the triumph of democracy, the triumph of liberal open markets, and that the East would become westernized, you know. And of course, what that leaves out of the equation is the power vacuum that ensues as a result of these big changes, and who goes into that power vacuum, who's strong enough or ambitious enough or wealthy enough or ruthless enough to go into those particular power vacuums.
China springs to mind, Jim.
Well, of course, China, but also Russia, you know. And yes. I mean, Russia, as you're well aware, the way it's been flexing its muscles in recent years in particular, India, Pakistan, like you've got to factor in all of these different equations. It's interesting what you're saying about leadership in relation to Europe also. I mean, Angela Merkel is also departing the stage.
Yes.
The longest-serving leader in the EU, who you could argue had a very firm view of what Europe needed to do and what the European Union needed to do. And the historical assessments of Angela Merkel would be very interesting in that she may well be credited with the courage of her political instincts around the refugee crisis in 2015. And remember, surrounding all of these conflicts, you have refugee crises, and we're going to have another refugee crisis as a result of the current instability. She may be credited with that, but she also may be criticised for the extent to which she pursued a Germany first policy, as opposed to being concerned about the wider European project. And there are also some debates, of course, about the Eurozone, about the economic crash, about austerity and everything else. So, you know, you'll get a mixed assessment there. No more than we've, you know, how many biographers of JFK have there been? You know, I can find five historians who will celebrate the heroism and the achievements of JFK, another five who will denounce him. And, you know, you can focus on rhetoric, you can focus on defining speeches, and even in relation to Afghanistan, of course, there's that moment at the beginning of the invasion in 2001 and declaration of wars on terror. And they don't resonate very well down through subsequent decades, because when you go digging deeper, you can realize that certain pious assertions can be made about values and about a Western way or about the right thing to do. But then there's all the murky side deals that are made. You know, the romancing the Taliban that was going on that I referred to recently in the 1990s prior to 9/11. So, you know, it is always much murkier. Self-interest can be defined at different points by different regimes in ways that suit their moments. But what we are dealing with, obviously, at the moment is both in America and in Europe that are much more fractured, that don't have the coherence of vision about where they want to be and how they're going to get there. And even within Europe now, what are we seeing within Europe more and more frequently? Walls being built, you know?
Yep.
So even if you go back to the so-called cornerstone of the European integration philosophy, that's under significant pressure also.
It is. Chris, the British were, throughout the 20th century, regarded as staunch allies of America, and the mood of the British people, I thought, was captured very well in that House of Commons debate last Wednesday week, when, before a full House, many of Boris Johnson's backbenchers were seriously critical of him, talked about the betrayal of their troops who had given their lives in Afghanistan, and that this was the wrong way to leave Afghanistan. There's nothing approaching American isolationism in Britain, or is there, given Brexit, the success of Brexit, and this idea, this nebulous idea of a global Britain, whatever that means?
I think that Britain is, in terms of what we actually do, revealing itself to be terribly isolationist. The rhetoric, the slogan, global Britain, is merely that. It is not being followed up by anything that could be remotely described as a genuine, well-thought-out, internationalist foreign set of foreign policies. Everything that they do, and particularly in the wake of Brexit, shutting the borders to people is being a big deal that has all sorts of ramifications. That they in the context of Afghanistan, they sound quite small, but we, you know, there is a shortage of 100,000 lorry drivers in the UK, and the road hauliers today are begging formally the government to allow some of those Eastern European lorry drivers that went home to come back. And the government has formally written back to them saying, no, Britain is all about not having that kind of immigration anymore. You must employ and pay your drivers accordingly such that you have enough of them. And there are countless other small examples of that where you must watch what people do rather than what they say. They talk a lot about global Britain, but everything that they do is about Britain first. In many ways, it's an England first policy, actually. And the other thing I would say about it is that it's a very ill thought out, it's a very superficial set of policies, and that whatever Joe Biden is doing, I suspect it is well thought out. Even with the flailing around, there is something of a strategic coherence, or at least a consistency with everything that Joe Biden has said and done over 40 years of being an American politician. He clearly has been thinking this way for a long period of time. the British government is defined by what they do, not by what they say. And what they are doing is consistent with, I think, very much isolationism. The army is not up to anything. Their armed forces have been denuded of all sorts of resources, not least money. So the idea that global Britain is actually going to amount to anything, I think, is a very remote possibility. And I think in similar and different ways, the UK is a very isolated place right now.
Dermot, the European Union has been mute throughout these times. And one wonders about the European Union, particularly if you look at Hungary and Poland, but Hungary in particular, where Viktor Orban has ripped up every rule in the democratic book. There is no free press. The judiciary are hopelessly compromised. He is determined to preserve what he calls their Judeo-Christian values. There is razor-sharp barbed wire and no entry. Yet, Hungary continues to receive aid and sustenance from the European Union. Can we say, in our own small way here in Ireland, or indeed can the French say, that we share values with Viktor Orban's Hungary? And if we don't, what does that mean?
What it means is that the international organisations that we are focusing on are out of date. You could argue, including the United Nations and NATO, which are obviously very relevant to the current situation.
Yes, and this was, we should remember, in Afghanistan, it had political cover from NATO. It was a NATO project in name anyway.
Yeah, but I mean, these are organisations and institutions that emerged from the ashes of the Second World War, and they're still structured in such a way that they reflect that post-1945 power balance. That does not mean that the United Nations is useless. I was listening recently to Sean Ridge, who's an ex-Irish Army man who's involved in one of the humanitarian missions for the UN out in Afghanistan. He's still there very courageously. But he did, in his interview, refer to the UN as being the eyes and the ears of the world now in Afghanistan. That suggests something very meek. You know, it suggests a kind of a salvage operation, you know, or an attempt to try and expose some of the perhaps coming excesses. So it raises a question, of course, about the effectiveness of these institutions and what they're supposed to do. You could argue the same is true of the European Union. I mean, you know, the main architects of European integration, of course, were intent on preventing further conflict in Europe. But European integration was also about a power balance within Europe, about France and Germany, about managing all of those historic tensions. And there was a delicacy around that. There still is a delicacy around that. And you've got to wonder, when is the project going to be updated to reflect these enormous pressures on the essence, supposedly, of the European value system? But, you know, going back to something Chris said earlier on, and going back to the sloganeering that goes on, you know, what is a European value system at this stage? You know, that's the nub of the question that you're raising. You know, there is no, one European value system now. European integration, our primary preoccupation in recent times really has been on markets, has been on finances, has been on, you know, how often did we hear for years about the markets and what the markets were thinking and the consequences of that for the feasibility of the European project. A lot of what has been lost, of course, and it may get worse, is that sense of an attachment to a shared sense of social justice or of values of some kind. It's very difficult, I think, to see how that is going to be sustained, given the increasing strength and populism of leaders in some of the countries that you're talking about, and their ability in particular to thrive on an anti-immigrant sentiment. And again, back to this question of the triumph of isolationism, we seem to be heading into a phase of international history that is going to be defined by that.
Chris, when you look back over our lifetime, there have been moments when leadership has made a difference, and the caliber of the person has made a difference. If you look at the Trump presidency, if you look at the Boris Johnson and his government and his leadership, we're weak, aren't we? These are people, Trump and Johnson, who believe in nothing, who are really essentially nihilistic, and who have no value system to defend.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's particularly true of Johnson, actually. He would be somebody that I would have studied far more closely than Trump. And I do firmly believe that Johnson is just a political opportunist and will do and say anything to win power and doesn't really know what to do with it. Brexit is the ultimate example of the dog catching the car. Brexit was done to put Johnson into 10 Downing Street. He achieved both objectives and really doesn't know what to do with either, because there is no underlying belief system there. Leadership can be defined in many different ways. At the political level, I like to think that it is about somebody, a man or a woman, finding something, anything really, around which a plurality of people can unite. The European Union was the easiest example one can cite of this in recent history, at least. Dermot mentioned it was formed to prevent war between France and Germany. I can count since Columbus discovered or fell upon the Americas, I think in my amateur historian way, I can count 17 times that France and Germany since then have gone to war in some shape or form with each other. Different historians might have a different count. And the European Union was able to unite around that one value. It had an economic dimension, but they were always very clear that the economic dimension around which Europe was uniting was to serve a higher purpose, which was to prevent war. In 2021, that almost seems anachronistic. We certainly hope so. Europe needs to define something else for what it stands. And I think that the one of the things that leadership could be doing at the moment speaks to that economic market dimension that Dermot referred to, is that in several respects, not all, but in several respects, the West's economic model has failed. And particularly, I'm referring here to the rise of various forms of inequality and social division. And surely there is a set of values there that a decent leader could unite, not everybody, but a plurality of people around. But these kinds of people are not there. The people who thrive on division are the ones leading the UK at the moment. It is all about division. It isn't about uniting people. Trump clearly was about the same. Biden is trying. But arguably, the United States, all that we're seeing is the divisions that have been around for a very long time, since before and during and after the Civil War. That there is a historic perspective to this that I think needs tracing out. But proper leadership is about uniting people around a small number of common values. And that, as you say, as we've all said this morning, is just notable by its absence.
I know, it's very interesting to think about that question of leadership. One of the things we perhaps do as well when we're living through a period where there's such an obvious failing of leadership, and of course Johnson, as eloquently outlined there by Chris, does not have an ounce of integrity. But one of the temptations is for us to look back then at historic leaders and forget their various failures. You know, I'm thinking of someone like Churchill, for example, who is a hero, apparently, of Boris Johnson. And, you know, there's a new biography out of Churchill at the moment by Geoffrey Wheatcroft. And he was making the point, yes, Churchill got it right once in 1940 and was forever remembered for that. But let's not forget what his contemporaries thought about him, particularly in the 20s and the 30s. They thought he was useless. They thought he was a chancer and a charlatan and a completely cynical opportunist, you know. So I'm not saying that that's how we should historically remember Churchill, but we do need to be careful, I suppose, of exaggerating the purity of historic leaders because of the mess we're living through at the moment. And I mean, I was in America for a year in 2008 when Barack Obama was first elected. And I again remember the optimism and the sense of possibilities and the idea that this was a historic breakthrough, as it was in some respects. But then you also have the challenge of delivering on the hope and the promise and the weight of history that's dragging you down, partly as a result of historic baggage and commitments that you inherit. Joe Biden is dealing with certain aspects of that at the moment. Having said all of that, you know, there clearly is in the modern era a devaluing of what constitutes good leadership. You know, and even going back to some of the themes that came up earlier on, whether it was European integration, when we think about people like Jean Monnet, some of the architects of post-war European integration, there is a genuine idealism there.
Yes.
If you go back to Eastern Europe and Willy Brandt and the policy of Ostpolitik and the attempt to try and forge better relations between Eastern and Western Europe, you know, you can see, obviously, genuine attempts at leadership, which can come at a domestic cost, but that there is that sense of them looking to a bigger picture. You're not going to get that with the likes of Johnson.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
No, Chris, the point I want to put to you, and I want Diarmaid to also address it, is the question of if you have leaders with no values, if your polity consists really of toadies, and that's the situation the United Kingdom finds itself in at the moment, where the Foreign Secretary won't take a call when Afghanistan is in crisis. He won't talk to the Afghan foreign minister and he won't talk to his own. He's in a luxury suite in Greece having a holiday. And there's an estimate in one of the broadsheet newspapers in Britain today that alone cost 1,000 lives. When you have people of that calibre, when you have the Trump presidency as well, and at the same time, there's nothing weak about the Chinese leadership. There's nothing weak about Russia's desires. So it seems as if we have a dissolute atmosphere politically in the West against a deadly determination among terrorists, among the Chinese leadership and Russia. So we are in trouble, are we not? And at the same time, we're tolerating Viktor Orban in Hungary, who's persecuting gay people. He's persecuting journalists, lawyers, judges. And of course, his racism is evident.
Yeah, if I was a Chinese Communist Party member today, I would be seeding articles in the Chinese press saying that the West is clearly decadent.
Yes.
That this is where democracy leads you. A group of politicians who, A, are not leaders, who get elected quite explicitly and openly telling lies, making promises that they have no intention of delivering on. The decadence is that everybody knows this. Their electorate knows that they are going to be politicians who will not deliver on any of their very flimsy and superficial promises. They're not able to do anything. They are not interested in the hard graft of government, the messy compromises that you need to make. Dermot spoke about those in order to get things done, because they have no idea what it is that they want to get done. The West is clearly decadent. The West is clearly failing. We need to take no lessons from the West. This is where democracy inevitably leads you, to the lowest common denominator of politician. We have the best system. I think the Chinese will be doing cartwheels today over what the state of the West.
Dermot, as a historian, can you sense what I and many of my friends can sense, that trouble is coming to us and to Europe eventually, that the Trump presidency touched a nerve in the American people? 74 million Americans voted for Donald Trump and everything that he stands for, which is some pretty terrible things. I feel there's a shadow now, and I want someone to speak for me. I want the European Union to deal with Viktor Orban. Viktor Orban's party is in the same group as Fine Gael in the European Parliament. And I'm not making a point here against Fine Gael.
Are you sure about that?
Well, no, hold on. What I'm addressing, Dermot, is a messy compromise. I don't think is acceptable.
Yeah.
But the wind seems to be behind those guys rather than behind us.
Yeah. I mean, one of the dangers, Eamon, is setting two systems up against each other. We define the other system as being rotten and corrupt. And we insist that it has to be taken on, that it has to be challenged. But one of the complications emerging, say from the situation we've been talking about in Afghanistan, is this question that was raised. I quoted him recently, Anthony Lake, who was a former security advisor, national security advisor in America. And he referred in the 1990s to the dangerous hubris of assuming that you can go in somewhere, impose your values, and nation build.
Yes.
And you referred earlier on to Joe Biden, you know, historically has been hostile to that concept. Because you know what it can lead to. It can lead to indefinite wars, and the Afghanistan conflict has been their longest war, you know, and they had Vietnam, of course, at a much earlier stage. So that's what it can lead to long term. And one thing that is not appreciated when those projects are undertaken are the deep cultural roots associated with the place that is now being occupied or that you have gone into.
Yes.
Understanding how those societies evolved and their values and their various evolutions and various identities and layers, and they're very complex layers. And of course, as Chris has alluded to, that feeds in to their own narrative of superiority then. And when you talk about Orban and Europe, you know, are you talking about some kind of intervention, you know, on the part of other European players to try and force them to account or to try and insist that they sign up to some kind of pan-European value system?
Yes.
That's not going to happen.
No,
what would that involve?
Well, it would involve justice for gay people, for example, and tolerance of people's differing views on many things. But you cannot, surely, without real danger arising, I'm putting this to both of you, actually, you cannot tolerate the cuckoo in the nest.
And but how do you force a Hungarian government to deliver equality?
First of all, you cut off the money supply.
Yeah.
And secondly, you say that if you want to be an ally of ours, and we're talking about allies here, you simply cannot do the things you're doing. They're unacceptable to us.
And then will you further stoke the very nationalism within Hungary that is creating the kind of problems that you're talking about? This is, again, Eamon, about the balance.
Right.
How do you strike the right balance between dialogue and sanction and intervention?
Well, I don't want to insult you by describing you as a limp-wristed liberal, but if you're saying, what can we do? Surely.
No, and I'm saying that historically, these are the options that you have. You know, you have economic sanctions, you have dialogue, or you have active intervention
in order to prevent.
Or expulsion. You have all of these different tools. And what I'm asking is, what is the right balance? Because you're talking about what could be coming down the tracks. Is there a possibility that you can exacerbate the fault lines that are already so painfully evident by too aggressive an approach or a policy?
But you must have red lines beyond which you cannot go that you are prepared to defend. If via this what can you do question, which is a very good one, and the messy compromises that result from it, you leave the world with the impression that you have no red lines, that you have no principles, you have nothing that you are willing to defend, that anything goes, which presumably is what I suspect Orban now thinks, that the EU is so weak that he could do anything now and the EU would not respond. There has to be some line beyond which the EU is prepared to say this far and no further. I agree with the practical difficulties of implementing something like that, but you cannot, the current status quo, if again, going back to that point, if I was Chinese, I would point to the EU and say, look, here is this wonderful organization called the EU that's founded on all these wonderful principles and values and interests that it's prepared to defend, and it no longer has any of these. Look at what is happening on its eastern fringes, and that the EU, anything goes. And I think that's the thing that's wrong, is that we are unable to say, okay, yeah, it's hard, but this is a line beyond which we are not prepared to tolerate.
Yeah, I want to put it to you, Dermot, and again to Chris also, that Donald Trump began negotiating with the Taliban in 2018 and reached agreement in 2020 with the Taliban. And Joe Biden and Boris Johnson were talking last week about the Taliban rebuffing them. And it was the Taliban who said they had a red line. And their red line was August 31st, in other words, today. Get out. And we're not going to do it. So here you have a savage, nihilistic, brutal, murderous insurgency represented by the Taliban at the negotiating table. And we weren't telling them what to do. We were asking. They were telling the West, you're out. No. And then what the London Times described as rebuffing. This is intolerable, surely.
Yeah. And what they will argue, of course, those who are on the way out and have left, is that the alternative is a permanent presence, is a permanent commitment, is a permanent conflict that will not play well domestically. Donald Trump, of course, was completely focused on the idea of America alone, America at home, and he was quite comfortable with cozying up to various tyrants. But what he was also doing, of course, was seeking to deliver on this idea that I am going to end these unnecessary American commitments abroad. And, you know, going back to some of the other themes we talked about earlier on in relation to isolationism and defining a foreign policy vision, do they want permanent involvement in Afghanistan? What historically has Afghanistan revealed in relation to Western intervention?
The graveyard of empires, I think you called it in your piece in the Irish Times.
That's the title of the book of the experts history, driving about.
Yes. They should have read the history books before they went in and stuck to their original objective. Yeah. Their original red line was to get rid of Al-Qaeda. The nation-building, state-building thing came afterwards. That justification was not mentioned when the troops were going in. There was no intention to rebuild Afghanistan. It was simply to respond to 9/11. And there's an argument about whether or not they should have read their history books back then, and they should have known that if they were going to be in there, they would have been in there for a long time, and this would have been the result.
If you excuse me for a moment, Chris, I'll just read something from Dermot's piece in last Friday's Irish Times. He said, in June 2009, President Barack Obama insisted, we can't rebuild Afghanistan into a Jeffersonian democracy. That same year, he committed 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan. Now,
yeah.
So it isn't a failure of intellect in the case of Obama. It's a failure of political will, surely.
And I think the Americans themselves, well, some Americans are using this forever war argument as to, well, how long would we have been prepared to stay in Afghanistan? Why are we committed to them? What interests does it serve? Well, I think you need to set that against the simple point that they have more troops in the United Kingdom than they had in Afghanistan. And I don't think there's much sense. I don't know what those troops are doing here, what interests they're defending. But America has all sorts of hundreds of thousands of troops around the world. There's no sense that they're being pulled out of South Korea or the United Kingdom. 2,500 troops, none of whom were dying in the past year or two, were keeping the peace. So framing this in a slightly different way, I think, produces a different answer.
Okay, Dermot, just a final question to you about the Taliban, the nature of them, whether they will ever be partners, and what is going to happen to the women. There are 38 million Afghans, and 18 million of them are women and children, and young women, young girls who won't be able to go to school, women who won't be able to work and fulfill their lives. These people are medieval, and doing a deal with them. I'm not suggesting for one moment that America should be in there at all, but doing a deal with them surely sends a shocking signal of where we are as believers in the West and liberal values.
It's a terrifying prospect. What is going to happen to women, the status of women under that kind of a regime. And there has been extraordinary work done, it has to be acknowledged, particularly on the part of NGOs and voluntary groups in relation to education and women and work. And, you know, the idea that that will all be ripped up is obviously a terrifying prospect. But you talk about, dealing with a regime like that, accepting a regime like that. It's been done before. And this is the thing about the contrast between the rhetoric of disgust at what a regime like that would do and the reality of power politics and financial and strategic thinking about foreign policy, that they may well decide that we have to be entirely pragmatic in how we deal with the Taliban now, because we don't want to go back. We don't want to commit troops. We don't want to have to deal domestically with the idea of more dead bodies or more dead soldiers. And all of the huge expense that comes with in continued involvement. And then, of course, that would make you entirely cynical about what constitutes a moral foreign policy. But you search in vain for a consistent moral foreign policy in any of the eras that we've been talking about.
Yes. Okay, Chris, just a final question about where we are in the West, in Europe, particularly in the absence, and I would argue in the looming absence, of an America that is prepared to be and to lead a Western alliance in either NATO, in the United Nations, or in any way. Because although you say, both of you, that they, and you said particularly, Chris, they're not pulling out of the UK, not pulling out of South Korea, and have sworn that they will defend Taiwan, it doesn't look like it from here. At least the mood music doesn't.
Yeah, where our interests lie and how reliable the United States is are questions that are being asked today. All of the media outlets, all of the pundits are asking those questions. I think more deeply, thinking more deeply about Europe, given where we're sitting, is the thing for us to do. Where are Europe's interests? And are they being defended appropriately? And is the United States a reliable partner going forward? We were asking those questions under Trump. They're now back. I was worried about Europe before Brexit. Brexit has proved to be a peculiar unifying force for Europe, given it's something to stand against, if you like. Now that Brexit is done, now that it is over, that's going to fade. And those questions, those worries about what Europe is in the 21st century are going to come back. And I would be very worried, and therefore would urge all of our politicians to be very focused on a new European vision, a new European ideal, because otherwise the fractures that we have identified in the European Union are going to widen. I think as an economist, they've got a huge economic dimension, and there are lots of economic and financial things that could be done to make Europe a better place with a better vision, a better set of ideals. But it does require a different set of leaders.
Diarmaid, I'll leave the last word with you in terms of the trends.
We, as a result of Brexit, postponed an awful lot of our critical faculties.
Yes.
Or put them to one side when it comes to the European project. Isn't it interesting that in this country there was a growing sense of the faults of the European project and of the European Union? And, you know, even when you look back at referenda not that long ago, where it was clear that there was a strand of thinking about Europe which is becoming more critical, part of that was self-interest because we were no longer the poorest of the EU countries and we were wondering how much we were getting out of it. But there was another element to it, which was questioning where this project was going and in whose interests it was.
Yes.
We need to come back to those questions. We were very grateful for the solidarity that was shown in relation to the border. And of course, we became so preoccupied because we often see things through an Anglo-Irish lens for understandable historic reasons that, again, we forgot the idea that we needed to be thinking in deeper European terms. And when we joined the EEC we became formally a member in 1973. There was a referendum in 1972. And the Taoiseach at the time, Jack Lynch, was making the point that we haven't been thinking European. We lack the breadth of outward vision, he said.
Yes.
And that phrase often comes back to me 50 years on. You know, where's our outward vision now in relation to what Europe can become?
Okay, Professor Diarmaid Ferreter and Chris Johns, I'm very grateful to both of you for that thought-provoking conversation. Thanks to Diarmaid, thanks to Chris, thanks to all of you for listening. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.